listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked-about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host, and with me today is Duke Dang. Duke is the general manager of Works in Process at the Guggenheim. That's right, I said at the Guggenheim. And what's going to be so interesting about this interview is that we're going to learn something that many people don't know, which is that museums, even the Guggenheim, can have performing arts alongside of the visual arts. And Duke Dang's program, Works in Process, which has been around for more than 20 years, is one such program. And you're going to learn about how this is done and the amazing results and positive outcomes that it can produce for those who experience this. If I told you, for instance, that you could go to a performing arts concert and meet the artist, also go behind the scenes and really understand what's motivating the artist to perform in the way that they are, to actually see a production in progress before it actually premieres, you would probably say that was a great opportunity. Well, you can get these, and they do this at Works in Process. And Duke is going to spend some time with us talking about how this all comes together. He's also going to talk about his amazing life. He came to the United States under very humble conditions. And it was actually philanthropy and our government that helped him get to a place where he could actually be in a position to head an organization like this. Duke, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Art.
Well, Duke, it's so great to have you here to learn about the work you're doing as general manager at Works in Process. And we really are fascinated to have this opportunity to have you with us and learn about your background and what drives you to do this important work. If you could, tell us a little bit about Works in Process and why you believe it's so important to our society right now.
Yes. So Works in Process is a performing arts series. We call the Guggenheim Museum home. And what makes Works in Process distinct and unique is that we strive to illuminate the creative process of the artists of our time. These artists have incredible stories to tell. The work that they create reflect the world that we live in. And not only do we want to tell their stories through programs that blend discussion with performance, but we also support their creative process. You know, I think we've all been at a party or a cocktail event where we're having a drink and somebody starts to talk about something or reference something. And if you don't know what they're referencing, right away, you are not a part of the conversation anymore. And what makes Works in Process unique is when you attend a Works in Process program, the artist is always there to share their intention. They talk about what they're trying to achieve, what they're trying to do, the story they are trying to tell. And layered on top of that, the audience gets to see the performance highlights of what they're trying to do. So we all have seen the same thing. We're all on the same page, and we all can access this information, and we all get to share and engage in this knowledge creation. So it's completely democratic, completely accessible. We don't want to leave anybody behind.
Where did Works in Process come from? How did it begin? What's its origin?
Works in Process was founded in 1984 by Mary Sharp Cronson, who is a mentor of mine, a very good friend of mine. And I am the person I am professionally because of Mary Sharp Cronson. Mrs. Cronson was born into a very philanthropic family. Her mother was the board chair of the Martha Graham Dance Company. She was on the board of New York City Ballet, as well as the Guggenheim Museum. Her brother was the board chair of New York City Opera. And being that they were that involved and that supportive of the performing arts, these patrons are able to gain access and insight and behind the scenes to how the performing arts are created, oftentimes through studio visits, a chance to meet the artists and the creators. And she thought, you know, it's not really fair that only patrons have access to this level of immersion and understanding. And that's why she created Works in Process. At every Works in Process, you get to meet the artists, you get to hear what they're trying to do, you get to see behind the scenes performances before they premiere. And she wanted to create that access for people who aren't philanthropic or don't have the ability to be philanthropic. But again, she wanted the program to be incredibly democratic, very accessible. And that was how Works in Process was created in 1984.
So given that creation, it's remarkable how much it's grown in that time. It looks like there are quite a few organizations that have adopted this way of engaging their audiences. You want to talk about how some of that has occurred?
Yeah, Mrs. Cronson really was a pioneer for her time. In 1984, very few museums were presenting the performing arts, and that's why the Works in Process was able to come into being, in that there was a theater at the Guggenheim Museum that was not being fully utilized. And Mrs. Cronson, being on the board, said, can we have performances in this space? And fast forward to 30 years, I've been with the program for 18 years now, and I remember how, just as I was getting involved in 2003, other museums were starting to see the value of having the performing arts and that they bring a whole new audience to the museum. But you think about how pioneering this program was. It was, in a way, reality TV before reality TV. It was reality performing arts before what we today now understand is the genre of reality TV, because it was a chance to go behind the scenes and learn the story and have an understanding of the artists and the work that they create. And when you understand something, when you get to meet a creator, there's just a greater appreciation, a higher level of ownership. These are the stories that we get to hear. And when you hear stories, you become involved, invested. And that was how the program really grew, as people engaged further and gained a deeper understanding of how works are created. They just wanted more. And because of that, we continued to grow the programming. And now we do about 60 performances a year, when back in 1984, we were doing about 4 to 5 performances a year. And we are pretty much at capacity at the Guggenheim in the theater, because it's hard to get more dates, because we do share the theater with multiple departments at the museum.
Sure. So I was just thinking, if someone hasn't really experienced your work, what would they take away? What would they experience? Take us through an event, if you would.
Okay. I think last Works in Process program that happened before the pandemic was a program called Swing, which explored the history of swing dancing and Lindy Hop. And in this program, dance and Lindy Hop is on a continuum. It's constantly evolving. So we had Mickey Davidson, who is a legend within the swing dance community, moderating the discussion with the current generation of pioneering swing dancer Lindy Hoppers. And while Mickey Davidson was providing that historical grounding of the tradition of Lindy Hop, this younger tradition was pushing Lindy Hop into the future. So while Lindy Hop traditionally was a very gendered dance where the lead was a man and the follow was a woman, the current generation of Lindy Hoppers were saying, well, why can't lead and follow be genderless? Anybody can lead and anybody can follow. And we were demonstrating how this can happen on stage so the audience can see it and understand it. And then layered on top of that, there was pushing the envelope by having that lead and follow happen during a dance where a man can lead, then follow, then lead, then follow. And the woman can lead, then follow in one song. Or there could be two women that are dancing that, and they both are leading and following. Or there could be two men that are dancing and they're leading and following. And so as an audience member, you're seeing this evolution of, well, Lindy Hop was very gendered, to look at what the pioneers in this moment are pioneering now. And what they're creating is so topical and relevant to the world that we live in today.
What a great example of how art mirrors what's going on in our society.
Right.
Or maybe in some cases leads what happens in our society.
Right. And if you didn't have the chance to have these pioneering proponents of what lead and follow can be right there talking about their intention and then demonstrating it, somebody who isn't familiar with Lindy Hop might look at it and not actually understand how groundbreaking this work is. They're sure. Seeing the Lindy Hop dance, but without that explanation, you don't fully grasp how rich, how powerful, how pioneering this work is.
Yeah. You mentioned the theater at the Guggenheim. I would think a lot of people don't realize there is a theater at Guggenheim. We don't necessarily associate it with performances.
It's New York City's best kept secret. It really is.
Yeah. I was going to say, and how did that come about?
Well, the theater was original to the building. It's designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. It is singular, unique. It's an all-white space. It's circular. And if you close your eyes and you think about the Guggenheim Museum and you think about how would a theater look, well, it makes a lot of sense. It's 285 seats. It's incredibly intimate and very comfortable. And because everything is white, the seats are white, the carpet's white, the walls are white, it's very open and accessible and very bright and welcoming. We welcome, on average, 15 to 16,000 audience members a year. And I'm very proud of that number. But the truth is that the Guggenheim Museum, on an average year, welcomes 1 million visitors. So when most people who come to the Guggenheim, they come to the gallery space and the iconic spiraling rotunda. They don't really know that a theater exists, but we keep that theater very busy and occupied with live performances. And my mission is try to change this notion that the theater is New York City's best kept secret, because we, as you can hear, the words that I constantly say over and over again is we try to make the performing arts as democratic and as accessible as possible and as welcoming as possible.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. That was going to be my next question about making the arts accessible, particularly those that in the past haven't necessarily been open to broader audiences and maybe have even turned those audiences away. We're now seeing, though, that arts organizations are understanding this and are trying to make strides to change. Are there specific tactics and strategies that you're using in addition to what you just mentioned that will drive those particular audiences to come and participate and to feel a part of it?
Yes, absolutely. What we have been doing for the past 3 years, I should say 3 years ago, we really looked at our programming and we realized that a lot of our programming was grounded in ballet and modern dance. And we said, wait, we live in New York City, the birthplace to hip hop culture, you know, the South Bronx, 1970s. And this hip hop culture has created incredibly rich performing art traditions that have spanned the entire world. But here we are in New York City and we need to celebrate what was created in New York. And so we also looked at the dance concert world and realized that street dance was underrepresented and I would say historically marginalized within the dance concert realm. And so we said, we need to change this. And we started to invite creators that represent this street dance, hip hop, house, dance house music, club culture that is so distinctly New York and so American in every single way. So our first project that we commissioned was called Underscored by a choreographer by the name of Efrat Ashery. And Efrat said, well, you know, the house dance, street dance tradition that I am a part of goes back to the 1970s. And I want to bring in elders from that community. I want to bring in people like Archie Burnett, who is just a legend within that world. And because these creators of club culture are still alive, they can still tell their stories. And that's what that was our first project that really started to provide a platform for this underground culture that never really has had a platform like Works in Process at the Guggenheim. And you can say that this club culture is a byproduct of Black and Brown communities being marginalized in New York City in the 70s, right? And it's an expression of that resilience in being marginalized. And that project will finally premiere we were supposed to premiere it in 2020, but the pandemic put the project on pause, and we will be premiering it in the 21-22 season. So dance, the performing arts, it's a lineage, it's a family. And as we were working with Efrat Ashery, we came to know a choreographer by the name of Omari Wiles. And Omari is a legend within the ballroom community here in New York City. He was a member of the Mizrahis, and recently he founded his own house, the House of Orici. And we wanted to welcome the ballroom community to the Guggenheim. Again, this is a tradition, a performing art culture that has been historically marginalized and not given the resources and the platform that other forms of dance have been provided. And so on, we've invited crumpers and flexors and b-boys. We've brought in beatboxers. And all of these performing art forms are so incredibly virtuosic. It is immediate. You do not need to have a deep performing arts education or appreciation to say, wow, this is impressive. They just haven't had the platforms that other performing art traditions have had. And so that is what we have been doing for the past 2 to 3 years, is how do we provide a platform for these historically marginalized, underrepresented traditions, and how do we tell these stories? And now is the time to do it.
Duke, you have a fascinating background for someone who's risen to this place in the performing arts world. You were born in a relatively poor community. Your family had to use Section 8 vouchers, food stamps. You were even on welfare at one point. And yet you don't find many people, I would think, coming from those communities who take to performing arts at the level of the Guggenheim's theater. And I'm just curious, what drove you in that direction? How did you develop an interest? What connected you to that world?
Oh, gosh. I think it's a passion. I was very fortunate. I was never, growing up, I was never, ever exposed to the performing arts. We are refugees. We immigrated to America from Vietnam. We were boat people. I was born at a UN refugee camp. We were rescued by a German humanitarian ship in the South China Sea. And as you mentioned, when we came to America, we were completely empty-handed. Section 8 vouchers, food stamps, welfare, been there, done that. And I was very fortunate that when I applied to college, I had a scholarship from, I was part of the inaugural Gates Millennium Scholars cohort, which is an initiative funded by Bill and Melinda Gates. And so I had the incredible privilege of being able to go to college on full ride. I went to Boston University, and within the first semester, I changed my major to art history because I just fell in love with an elective class, Art History 101. And I was just so fortunate that at Boston University, the textbook was Gardner's, and two of the authors were actually my professors. And many of the artworks that were featured in Gardner's are on display at the MFA in Boston. So that ability to learn about art in the classroom, but also to be able to see the artwork in person at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston was so powerful. And that was where I really began my journey in art appreciation and how art allows us to connect to the past, to look into the future, and the incredibly rich tapestry and story that art tells, and how it translates across multiple cultures. And that was, as a child growing up in a family where my parents didn't speak English, I was constantly spanning multiple worlds, whether it was, you know, firmly entrenched in the Vietnamese Little Saigon community that I grew up in Southern California, but also being American. It's a world that I still span. And I think that art has the ability to transcend these cultures. Growing up, I am the byproduct and the recipient of the generosity of an American system of social services, that what I'm doing now to support artists and to make the arts as democratic and accessible as possible really is that cycle on repeat. And it's interesting because my little sister works in affordable housing, and she provides learning and skills for individuals that live in affordable housing. And I've always thought, gosh, you know what? I work in the arts. This is like nothing. The need is not anything compared to what my little sister does, right? In New Orleans, in incredibly marginalized communities where she's helping people access internet and making it possible for them to have the skill sets to start to work in hospitality, which is, you know, a really good job for the communities that she's working in. And what this year has really taught me is that the arts, as an arts administrator, these artists rely on arts organizations to support them. And that's what, in a way, we have done this past year between our bubble residency programs, as well as the virtual commissioning that we do, is to say, you know, we see you, we're here to support you. And that's why I think so many in the arts are hoping and are wishing that there would be a return of the WPA program that happened in the New Deal, right? And unfortunately, that there still is really no news of something like that happening. But I think arts administrators are trying to change that. You know, wouldn't it be great to have a WPA program to support artists again?
That's very important dialogue that you've just shared. We do need something to transcend our cultures. We continue to experience discrimination. I know you've been aware of anti-Asian discrimination and obviously are working in your own way to address that. I'm hopeful, and maybe you are too, that through art and performing arts and arts of all type, we might be able to bridge differences. What is your sense of that? What is your sense of the power of art?
Yeah.
Maybe like sports to bridge gulfs.
You know, we've been doing a lot of work in the dance realm. And the reason why we work in dance is, well, A, first off, dance traditionally has been the least resourced field of the performing arts. And so we want to devote our resources to an area that is least resourced. But also, what's so incredible about dance is it's something that we can participate in. And this is why we're so excited to be working and championing street dance. Part of it is that it responds to the architectural space that we are in. Unlike many forms of dance, which are concert dance, which are seen on a proscenium stage with an audience in the seats, street dance tends to happen in a circle, in a cipher, right? And the Guggenheim building itself is a circular building. But being in a circle also is a sense of building community. You know, we're standing in a circle, and part of street dance and part of the building that we're in is you may see a performance in the theater, but then you walk upstairs and you're in a vast, enormous, open space that's round. And so we can continue that dance. So the audience goes from being a spectator into a participant. And that's what we were doing before the pandemic, is we would continue the dance in the rotunda by teaching the audience how to dance and asking them to dance with the dancers. And if you're dancing with a stranger who has attended a performance with you, that's when you're starting to build community, right? And that happens, you can say that happens at a party or at a wedding where you're at a function where you don't know anybody or you don't know everybody there. And all of a sudden you've met people on the dance floor because you're just so, you're experiencing so much joy that comes with this physical expression we all can access, regardless of what culture we come from.
Tell me a bit about the outdoor and site-specific work that came about as a result of the pandemic.
So I think this all goes back to our mission as a performing arts organization that supports the creative process and supports artists. It started really when the pandemic just canceled all gigs for all performers, all artists. And we just said, we can't hibernate. What can we do to support artists right now? And the first thing that we did was we said, well, we're not going to cancel on artists. We're going to find a way to continue to compensate them, support them financially and creatively. And we initially launched a series of virtual commissions, but that was just a band-aid for a much bigger problem that became very obvious 6 weeks after the pandemic set in. And so we said, well, how can we make it possible for artists to safely gather? And this is when we realized there are residency centers in upstate New York that are on 100 acres, 150 acres, where if we could bring artists together in these isolated venues, then they can start to create, to perform again. And we were fortunate to access testing last summer of of 2020, which at that time, tests were taking 7 days, 8 days to return results. And through Dr. Wendy's eye check, we were able to access rapid testing that would take 2 to 4 hours. And we created a protocol where artists would self-isolate at home for 7 days, get tested 2 times, and after their second test, they would be able to enter these quarantine bubbles at upstate New York to rehearse and create. While this was happening, we started to reach out to local municipality legislators to say, well, could we have live outdoor performances this summer, summer of 2020, if we kept people very distanced and outside? And in a partnership with Catspawn Cultural Park and the Village of Tivoli, New York, and the legislators of Dutchess County, we were able to secure permission to produce what, as far as I know, the first outdoor performances, live in-person performances in New York State in August of 2020. And it was through a combination of the protocol that we had created for the artists to safely gather them, combined with the fact that this was happening on 150 acres and we were allowing only 50 audience members sitting very, very far apart on a grassy field to see these live performances. But it all is in the spirit of how do we support these artists right now and not taking no for an answer. It's finding out where the yeses are. And in doing this, it was providing hope for the artists, but hope for the community as well, to know that even in the darkest of times, there is a way forward.
Yeah. Wow. So you also had this process of residencies and bubbling.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yeah, that was, so I briefly touched on it in that last question, but it really was, how do we continue to support artists during the pandemic? And
yeah, you're just putting them in these bubbles.
Putting them into the bubbles. So it was really May of 2020, when the idea came to mind. My husband and I were spending a lot of time in the Hudson Valley, where we have a home. And 9 years ago, we started the Hudson Valley Dance Festival with dancers responding to AIDS. And so because we had started the Hudson Valley Dance Festival, we were already very familiar with many of the dance institutions and residencies in the Hudson Valley. And we reached out to them and said, what are you guys doing? And all of these residencies said, we're completely empty, we're shut down. But they were sitting on 150 acres of land with studio space and housing. And in New York City, all the studio space and all the theaters were closed. So it was thinking about, how do we bring these artists into these bubbles? I was very fortunate in that I was able to get my hands on Tyler Perry's protocol. He, in May, had announced that he was planning on opening up production in Atlanta. And after getting my hands on those protocols, it was thinking, how do we take a nonprofit budget and best we can match what Tyler Perry was doing? And so he was chartering a private jet and flying talent from LA to Atlanta and testing the pilot. And well, we said, we can't charter a private jet, but we said, we can charter a private bus. And instead of testing the pilot, we'll test the bus driver. And Tyler owns his production facility, Atlanta, but we don't own that. But again, knowing that these residency spaces in the Hudson Valley, 2 hours away from New York City, exist, we said, well, we can certainly partner with these residencies that are sitting empty. And actually, we're very happy to partner with us because we were enabling them to do what their mission is, which is to support the creative process of artists. They just didn't have the protocol. So it really was a confluence. And then on top of this, the NBA bubbles had been announced. And so as a small nonprofit, it was really gathering that information and processing it in a way that was achievable at the scale that our resources permit.
That's fascinating and so creative. And, you know, as the old adage says, the show must go on. And you found a way to make sure that it did. So as I think about your work and your creativity, I am wanting to ask you, what do you think will stick after the pandemic that you've learned during the pandemic that can help drive new audiences and further the creative process at the same time?
Well, I think first off, it's this past year, it's been a year of no's, right? You can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. But you need to focus on the yeses, right? What can you do? And what are the pieces of the puzzle that you need to put together in order to get that yes? And then I think my hope, I mean, my concern is that are we, the performing arts, going to continue doing what we have always done? Which for us, the answer is no. You know, the world has changed and our decision making needs to change to reflect the world. And also as we emerge from the pandemic, we need to think about what representation looks like. And my concern is, and it's a quandary because many organizations booked their programming for the 2021 season, which was completely canceled. And it is important to honor those commitments to those artists. But those decisions were made in 18 or 19. And so as we start to reopen in 21-22, how do we continue to honor the commitments that were made 2-3 years ago, but also to reflect the world that we live in right now? So it requires, I think, a lot of nimbleness in our decision making. And so that really has been our mantra here at Works in Process is, as we emerge from the pandemic, what does representation look like? And that is, I think, what most performing arts organizations are thinking about right now. And for us, it's very clear that we need to be presenting a broader array of performing art cultures and traditions. And we need to tell broader stories. And that's what we are doing already. We're very fortunate in that Works in Process was the very first live indoor performances that were permitted in New York City, or in all of New York State, I should say. We reopened live performances on March 20th. Yeah, I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, I think it does. And I had a futurist friend of mine on recently who talked about the world we live in as a world of and. You know, it's not a world of or. So, you know, we can take advantage of some of the things and commitments that we've made in the past and do new things at the same time. We just have to think about space. And in your case, it looks to me that you've been able to use space that you don't even own to be able to accomplish certain performances and to come up with new venues, to come up with new audiences. So in this and world, I think maybe it's just a function of creativity as you obviously are and have been in your career in this work.
Also, what's really important is putting it in the context of we are a New York City-based organization. And unlike many places in America, New York City has seen a loss of population that is significant. And on top of that loss of population, 1.6 million commuters are now not commuting into New York City anymore. So this is decimating the city's economy. And arguably, New York City's economy is the driver for a lot of the country's economy. And so how do we, as a performing arts organization, play a role in the recovery of New York City? And by having these live performances, it's a way of bringing people back to New York City. I mean, the performing arts are incredibly effective at gathering people. And that's why the performing arts are one of the industries to last reopen, because we gather people. But that's how New York City is going to recover, is by having people come back to the city. And I think that as we emerge from the pandemic, there is going to be this need for us to gather.
Yeah. Well, Henry Timms was a podcast guest from over at the Lincoln Center. And he mentioned, and when I asked him, so what do you think? Are people going to be ready to come back after the pandemic? He says, hell yeah, they're going to be ready to come.
Absolutely. We've produced now 12 live in-person performances since March 20th. Every performance has sold out. And because of the Department of Health guidance to us, special guidance, we're only permitted to sell tickets 72 hours before a performance, which is a very short window of time. But we are selling out performances in a matter of minutes. By nature of the Department of Health limiting us to 30 minutes, we right now, the performances that we're championing, we can't have a discussion component because it's so short. And also the rotunda is so acoustically problematic that we can't really have a discussion. And also we would always have a post-performance reception, which we can't do right now. You know, it's this very weird moment where I don't know when we're going to be able to go back to our old model of presentation in the theater, but that's okay. People want to gather. They want to feel that exchange of energy between audience to audience, audience to performer. And it makes me so happy when people say, you know, my hands hurt because I haven't gotten the chance to clap like this in so long.
That's wonderful. So here's a last question as we wind down the podcast. How are some of your more traditional audiences and patrons responding to this new emphasis on greater diversity in the art forms and in the presentations of the art?
I'm really, really, really proud of what has happened in that all art organizations and nonprofits are built on trust. And your audience members, if you've done a good job, they trust your decision-making. And our audience has come back to our performances. And I've been receiving very, very, very positive feedback. By nature of the venue that we're working in right now, which is the Rotunda of the Guggenheim, which is not the theater, because we're not in the theater yet. We're working in the rotunda, yeah, which has a terrazzo floor, extremely hard stone floor. We really can't ask a ballet dancer in point shoes to dance on a terrazzo floor. It's even tough to ask modern dancers to dance on a terrazzo floor. So by nature of the infrastructure that's in place, and the programming that we already had in place before the pandemic, just coincidentally, street dance was born on the streets, right? The sidewalks, the concrete sidewalks, the asphalt floors, asphalt roads. These street dancers can actually dance in the rotunda of the Guggenheim. So it's about matching of infrastructure and skill sets. But yeah, the audience is eager to see performance right now. So there's an opening to introducing a new genre to my existing audience. And because my existing audience trust our decision-making, they've attended these performances, and as appreciators and as consumers of the performing arts, they do see the virtuosity of the performers that we are championing right now. And I think that they are excited to learn more, to go along for this ride. And this is the big lesson that we all are learning, right? Is because you like one thing doesn't mean you can't like another thing. It's just perhaps you haven't had the chance or the opportunity to experience it. So it goes back to, as we emerge from the pandemic, what do we program? What is represented? And at the heart of this is, and I think at the heart of our decision-making is the art that we are presenting of a certain caliber. And virtuosity is virtuosity. It's anything that inspires and creates awe is immediate. And what the pandemic did was it shut down our ability to participate in culture that is reflective of who we are as human beings, that are representative of our humanity. The performing arts provide the thread that are the embodiment of communities.
Yeah, and culture.
And culture, yeah.
Well, Duke, I want to really thank you for joining us on the Heart of Giving podcast. And to all of our listeners, I hope that you get a chance to experience the Rotunda at the Guggenheim to see some of these performances, and that you will also subscribe to our show here at the Heart of Giving podcast, which you can find on all major podcast platforms. And I thank you for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.